Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Tillman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we have an excellent guest with us today. We have Tamara Kaufman-Wittes from the Brookings Institution. Hi, Tamara.
Hey, ladies.
How are you this day?
So thrilled to be on Bombshell because I missed the amazing Rational Security Bombshell crossover, and now I get to make up for it.
And now we've had all of the Rational Security people on the podcast.
That's right.
Ben was here during our maniversary. We had the crossover. And now with you, we have now, this is now our bucket list is checked.
Do we have all the Infinity Stones?
Yes, we have all the
Excellent.
Collect all four.
That's right. What is everybody drinking?
I'm drinking a wonderful mug of hot tea, trying to recover from a terrible cold I have. So I will also try not to like cough and generally be gross in the general vicinity of this podcast. You're
That's
welcome
great.
In advance.
Thank God you're on Skype.
I'm dry over here in the Wittes household, sadly, but not to remain so for the entire evening, I hope.
Erin gave me a random beer from her fridge. That's great. It is the Joseph's Brow Radler Lemon Beer. I don't know what any of those words mean except for beer, so it's fine.
And I'm drinking a glass of bourbon out of a jam jar because I haven't run the dishwasher yet this week.
But that's like the most hipster thing you could possibly do.
It's not
right
even,
there.
I'm not very good at being a hipster, so I guess this is my entry. So we have lots to discuss, and we have some very serious topics to discuss with Tammy, but let's start with our bombshell questions. Lauren, do you want to kick us off?
Yes, and these are slightly out of order because I could not remember them all the time. Starting with, frankly, the most important one, actually, is Tamara, what is your favorite bar in the world?
Wow, in the world?
Yeah.
Well, my favorite bar in D.C. is easy. That's the bar at the Cosmos Club.
I knew it.
Where I'm a member, and I love to hang out there. But my favorite bar in the world is probably this wonderful rooftop bar in downtown Amman, where I had a magical Bellini on a magical evening one summer a couple of years ago. And that's suddenly become my favorite bar in the world.
I could use a magical Bellini. That sounds delicious.
Couldn't we all?
Next question. If you had to pick entrance music so that when we, you know, announced your arrival into a conference or a club or a coffee shop of any kind, what would your entrance music be?
Wow. So this answer may be embarrassing to a certain extent, but I'm going to own it because to me, it's the obvious answer. Christina Aguilera and Lil Kim's Can't Hold Us Down.
Wow.
It's pretty sweet.
That's great. I want to make this happen now.
At some point, we actually have to make a playlist for this.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to get somebody to go back and listen to all of this year's episodes and pull the songs.
Or like the greatest conference that ever was with a musical soundtrack to accompany it. I'm just saying.
Wow.
Perhaps yeah. I'll pitch that to the NatSec Girl Squad for their upcoming conference, which everyone should get
for
tickets
them.
To attend. Yes, indeed. Okay. Tammy, what is your most quoted movie line?
So I was a huge fan of the Pink Panther movies with Peter Sellers when I was a kid.
Nice.
And I think one of the reasons that I fell in love with my husband is because he was also a great fan of these movies. And so a line that we use quite frequently is the line that Peter Sellers gives when a huge something crashes through the ceiling onto a piano and crushes the piano. And the woman who owns the piano says, "But that was a priceless Steinway." And Peter Sellers responds in his horrible fake French accent, "Nit any mur."
I could think of many occasions where that might be useful.
So useful.
What book do you hate but everyone else loves?
Okay, this is going to make Erin really sad. And I'm sorry, Erin. This is just one on which we're going to have to agree to disagree. But
I know what it is.
I've never been able to get through Neal Stephenson's Cryptonomicon.
Oh.
I just can't do it.
I thought you were going to say Tinker Tailor. I'm literally rereading Cryptonomicon for the umpteenth time right now.
I know wow. You love that book. But I just can't get into it.
I get it. It's not for everyone. It's also really long and kind of tedious in places.
It's literally heavy. it's, carry yes, around. It's
but if you love Bobby Shafto, he'll just put up with it. So.
The funny thing is, I love some of Neal Stephenson's other books. I love some of his earlier books, some of his less disciplined, less crafted books, like Reamed, I thought was fantastic.
Oh, but interesting.
The whole Cryptonomicon trilogy thing, I just can't do.
I now very much want to have some sort of like Neal Stephenson roundtable / salon dinner where we all just get a little too drunk and talk about our favorite and least favorite books, all of which will be, I think, sort of deeply personal and idiosyncratic.
Cause... I could talk about Anathem for a really long time.
Yeah.
Yep.
Rada, we'll give you a book to read.
I was like, I don't know. I can come. I'll serve drinks.
There's probably a couple that I think you would like.
Yeah.
Okay, Rada, it's your turn for the last question.
What is the best use of data or statistics you have ever seen?
I don't know if it's the best, but it's a recent one that really makes me happy. And it's on the Brookings website. It is the public release of the Brookings Institution's workforce demographics.
Yes.
And it doesn't make me happy because it tells such a great story about our workforce demographics, but it makes me really happy that my institution made this data public and that we're committed to doing so on a regular basis. And that's going to push us to improve.
Well, this is the internal data from Brookings.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, the diversity or lack thereof of our scholar and non-scholar employees.
It was a really excellent display of both transparency and data and statistics. So I feel like you got a little twofer there. It was great.
Thank you. That means a lot coming from you.
Rada is a very happy camper.
I so am.
Okay, well, we have to shift gears to much less joyful topics here, Tamara. And you were the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for the Middle East and North Africa. I actually don't know how that billet is set up on the State Department side.
There were, believe it or not, 5 Deputy Assistant Secretaries of State for the Middle East, 3 with regional responsibilities, and then I and one other had functional responsibilities. So sort of a microcosm of the State Department right there.
Yes, I would agree with that. And we, of course, have been following this incredible story that we talked about last week on the podcast of Jamal Khashoggi. And we were now kind of into week 2 of not just the personal tragedy that is his apparent murder, but also now fully into the geopolitics of that. And so we were hoping that you might be able to walk us through a little bit of kind of the U.S.-Saudi relationship here, and both why this event seems to be something that has caught people's imagination, but also if it's something more than a tempest in a teapot. So enlighten us.
So it's definitely more than a tempest in a teapot. And I think that one reason why the killing, although the very gruesome and brazen killing of a single journalist, has caught so much attention in Washington, but not only in Washington, around the world. I think that this event has catalyzed a lot of long brewing concerns among policymakers and analysts about Saudi foreign policy, not just Saudi domestic repression, about the decision-making behavior of this young crown prince who, you know, he took over as crown prince a little over a year ago, ousting his uncle from the role, and has moved very swiftly to consolidate power in a system that, while it's an absolute monarchy, had been run in a way that distributed power among branches of the royal family. And instead, he's really managed to concentrate that power in himself. He's created new bodies in the royal court that have authority over ministries. He's fired and reorganized a lot of the ministers and cabinet positions. And he's also centralized all of the security forces, the various security forces of the kingdom, under his own control. And so he's been able to operate in an increasingly unconstrained way. And what we've seen is that he's used that increased authority in a way that is at least highly risk tolerant, and some might even call reckless. And that's, I think, created increasing concern here in the U.S. The kind of point of the spear for this policy concern is the Saudi war in Yemen, which he actually began when he was defense minister right after his father took power as king. And, so that's been 3 years plus. It's increasingly a military quagmire for the Saudis and Emiratis, and one that implicates the United States, because both President Obama and President Trump have been happy to sort of resupply Saudi weaponry, provide a little bit of assistance in refueling and maybe even in targeting. And that's caused a lot of collateral damage while also giving additional operating space for Al-Qaeda in Yemen. So the war has been a brewing problem. And I think that a lot of critics of Saudi policy in Washington have seized on this event as kind of symbolic of the problem with the crown prince's decision making and the need to rein him in.
So, Tamara, one question I have related to that is, so over the past week and a half, 2 weeks, there's been rumblings both from Congress as well as directly from the president that we do not want to rock the boat with our relationship with the Saudis for any number of reasons, whether because they are a vital security partner. President Trump himself has mentioned the purported arms deal, which is not exactly an arms deal, but like in his mind is going to create hundreds of thousands of jobs and result in millions of dollars or billions
of
dollars.
Millions of jobs this week.
So millions of jobs. And I feel like there's not a lot of clear understanding about, you know, what are the fundamentals of the relationship between the United States and the Saudis. And if we decided, if Congress or even the administration decided to put more pressure on them to adjust their behavior in some way or to as punishment for this, what kind of impact would that have? Or what sort of, I guess another way to think of that is like, what kind of leverage might we have to shape their behavior in some way?
Look, I think it's really a classic mythical debate that we have when we end up having problems in a relationship with an autocratic partner. And then all of a sudden, when some people propose that maybe we should change the relationship in some way, opponents of that will say, well, we don't want to disrupt the relationship. We don't want to rupture the partnership. We don't want to rock the boat. And there's always some reason why there's a lot at stake at this particular moment and we can't rock the boat. I find that a really puzzling argument to make in the present moment, because we didn't rock the boat here. The Saudis rocked the boat. Right. The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia decided to send a 15-man hit squad to another country to abduct and murder a dissident who was a permanent resident of the United States, and to use diplomatic facilities to do that. Like, that rocks a whole lot of boats, not just our bilateral relationship, but like basic norms of diplomatic behavior and the use of diplomatic facilities. So the boat is rocking, but it's not because we decided to rock it. The question is, how do we respond to that? They created a crisis. They created a crisis in the U.S.-Saudi relationship. They created a crisis in their global relationships. And that's why you see reactions, not just from, you know, President Trump or members of Congress, but from international investors. There are a lot of folks with who feel the need to respond to the Saudi decisions here.
And sort of just following that train along, like in, I think you guys said this in your recent episode of Rational Security, which is like on Earth 2, where we had a different administration with like a different structure, like what would a response look like to something like this? What would like taking this seriously involve in terms of diplomatic or other changes? And are we seeing that anywhere else? Like anyone else being this upset?
Yeah. So look, one of the things about having a longstanding, broad-based, multifaceted partnership with another government is that you actually have a lot of options at your disposal when you want to signal your displeasure or create a little distance. There are all kinds of symbolic as well as more substantive ways to do that. So, you know, Secretary Mnuchin was supposed to go to Riyadh this week for this investment conference. He's now decided he's not going to the investment conference, but he's still going to Riyadh. Like, so the easy symbolic move would be to do what several European governments have already decided to do, which is cut off all political visits. Like, for now, we're not sending any of our high officials to go see you because we're kind of pissed off, right? That's something that I think a normal US administration would do. They would have turned off that Mnuchin visit right away. Another thing a normal administration would do, I think, is recognize that this incident took place in Turkey. Turkey and Saudi Arabia have a very complicated and fractious relationship. Neither one of them can be trusted to investigate this incident properly or in an independent manner by themselves or together. And so a normal US government, I think, would have called very quickly for a credible independent international investigation. It would have offered to make the FBI available. You know, if you think about, for example, the assassination of Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri, you know, the U.S. worked at the United Nations to set up an international investigation of that incident. And that was something that a lot of other countries had stakes in, like this. But the Trump administration hasn't uttered a word about that possibility, which is kind of mystifying, quite frankly, because it would create a kind of a little bit of process that would buy them some time to figure out what they wanted to do.
Tamara, you remind me of another question here, which is, what are the Turks up to? They were really quick to leak that they had some details. There was sort of a little bit of back and forth leaks, but they're driving this story as much as anyone else. And I'm just sort of interested as to what they're getting out of revealing sources and methods or, you know, showing, you know, just sort of embarrassing the Saudis on this global stage this way.
So I think that they've got a bunch of things at stake. What they've managed to do here is definitely drive this story, as you said. Their leaking of the evidence they claim to have to media outlets was the thing that made it impossible for the Saudis to just make a blanket denial of any knowledge of Khashoggi's whereabouts. But of course, they haven't publicly produced that evidence and put it on the record. This has all been through leaks. And so that, you know, that suggests that what they wanted to do was make credible to the Saudis, make visible that they have leverage over them, and then maximize the value of that leverage. And so far, that seems to be working for them. But to the extent that there's continued pressure from governments, including the US government, including members of Congress, and so on, to produce the evidence, I think the Turks are going to come to the limits of their ability to wield that leverage. But what are the political interests at stake here? The Turks have been on the opposite side as the Saudis in this broad regional debate about what the future of governance in the Arab world should look like, what role there is for Islamist movements and political parties like those linked to the Muslim Brotherhood. Turkey and President Erdogan in particular are very much in favor of that Islamist model. That's where Erdogan comes from himself. And so Turkey's become kind of a haven for Muslim Brotherhood dissidents who are no longer comfortable or safe in their own countries. A lot of Egyptian Brotherhood, for example, are in Istanbul now. Syrian Brotherhood have been in Turkey for a long time. And so Khashoggi's death kind of challenges Turkey's brand as a safe refuge for these Islamist dissidents, and it challenges Turkey's brand as the leading state government acting on behalf of Islamist inclusion in Arab politics.
So there's been, in the last week or so, there's been a bit of fan fiction on Twitter, I would say, about it, people saying that, you know, the royal family is horrified by these actions by Mohammed bin Salman, or that his rule or his future rule is a bit shakier, and they're thinking of reshuffling the deck in terms of who will be the successor to the Saudi throne at some point in time. But in my mind, like, we haven't seen a lot of evidence for that. But that's related to another question I wanted to ask you, is how is Mohammed bin Salman viewed internally in Saudi Arabia? He's discussed in the media as anything from a major reformer to more lately being a bloodthirsty, unable to kind of manage his emotions, crazed millennial. there's clearly somewhere in the middle there that it is perhaps more accurate. But what is your sense of, at least internally in Saudi Arabia, how was he viewed in terms of his rule?
Look, I think it's very hard to make a solid assessment of that. It's not as though we have public opinion polling, and it's not as though if we did, because reportedly Mohammed bin Salman himself does conduct public opinion polling. I doubt that most Saudis would tell the truth to a pollster because they live in a very repressive environment, and they're very well aware that, you know, while half of the population of Saudi Arabia is on Twitter, they're very well aware that their government monitors that stuff really, really closely. And, you know, this is a society where the government's preferred views and opinions are enforced through a patronage system. This is a rentier state. The royal family runs it. They pull the oil up out of the ground, sell it on global markets, and drip that money down their patronage network to average citizens. And so everyone in Saudi Arabia is part of a family network, a network of families related to you by marriage, business networks on which you rely for your whole livelihood. And almost everybody's livelihood is linked to the government. So what that means is that people may have their doubts about the crown prince. They may have their doubts about specific policies, but they're going to express those doubts very cautiously and only to people whom they trust. I will say that, you know, when Mohammed bin Salman first became defense minister and launched the war in Yemen, I heard from Saudis that I know that they were a little concerned about the rashness of that decision, the quickness with which it was made. And they said, well, you know, we're used to a different style. We're used to doing things by consensus within the royal family. We're used to moving more slowly. Maybe this is a little too rushed. But that was as far as they were willing to go to me, right? I think it's very, very hard to gauge. The other thing I will say is that since he became crown prince, he's demonstrated a ruthlessness in suppressing dissent, both inside the royal family and beyond it across the kingdom, that has sent a clear message of intimidation to Saudi citizens. You know, he put his uncle, when he removed Mohammed bin Nayef as crown prince, he put him under house arrest. He was held incommunicado for weeks. He arrested dozens of his own cousins and put them in the Ritz-Carlton, where some were reportedly tortured before they signed some of their wealth over to the government or to Mohammed bin Salman personally. It's not really clear. And of course, there's been a continuous wave of arrests of human rights activists, of women's activists, and journalists and clerics with their own independent followings and things like that over the last year. So a lot of people in the kingdom are scared and worried, and that is palpable. I think even within the royal family, you probably have members who are fearful for their own livelihood, fearful for their own security. And the extent to which he's been able to centralize control makes it very hard to imagine a kind of opposition coalition forming within the family to get rid of him.
Wow. That is like just some excellent tour de force insight. And I feel really lucky that we were able to have you on, Tamara, to share that with us. And I hope we get to re-engage on this topic and for the next weeks and months as we figure out if this is actually going to change the underlying nature of the U.S.-Saudi relationship. So thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you guys so much for the chance to be on the show. I love Bombshell, and I'm so honored to be on Bombshell.
We look forward to the next crossover episode. Thanks, Tammy.
Yes, let's do it.
Shall we shift gears to keeping up foreign relations? One of the stories in the news this week, which I think we've actually talked about before, but maybe briefly, is what's being described as a caravan of migrants from Guatemala and Honduras, and they're currently sitting at the Mexico border, or maybe made their way through today. I was didn't keep full track, but
right, the border into Mexico.
The border into Mexico. And so this is part of kind of an ongoing challenge, both of essentially U.S. asylum policy, but also how that policy gets translated and enforced and rendered also by Mexico. And so I don't actually have a great like bit of analysis or a hot take, you know, on this, other than it seems like a real conundrum to have a couple hundred or a few thousand folks trying to move collectively through your country. It's also interesting to me that they're not looking for asylum in Mexico, which would be, I think, traditionally how asylum law would sort of work. But it's not the first time we've tried to look at economic asylum or economic migrants versus political asylum. I remember big debates about this, you know, in the 90s with regard to Cuban emigres versus Haiti or the Dominican Republic. And I don't know. Have you guys been following this?
Yeah, there's a few other details of interest. And this ties all into, I mean, the president has brought it into his how he's weighing in on the midterm elections. He has threatened to cut off foreign aid to some of the countries that these migrants are passing through, Mexico and others in the Northern Triangle. And on top of that is threatening to close the border altogether and send the military to enforce that closure. And whether or not any of these are serious statements of policy or just the typical sort of political bluster that he has at his rallies is a bit difficult to tell. This was, we're not going to talk about this in detail, but it's apparently at least related to a subject of a blow up between John Kelly and John Bolton outside the Oval Office, which I think my biggest hot take on that was there was more focus on the expletives that were used than on the policy debates. Hence, we don't really know a lot about what their policy debates necessarily
That's
were.
That's for White House mayhem.
Sorry. But it's now at about, I've last read 5,000 people as of Sunday evening that are making their way to the U.S. to seek asylum.
Yeah. And just like a couple other small points on this, which are one, I mean, there's a real question here about enforcement of the border and asylum law and international law about asylum seeking. So there's some questions on whether we can legally close the border to asylum seekers, part A, and part B is if these folks traveled caravan style through Mexico, unless I think they can demonstrate basically that they would continue to face the same life or death threats in Mexico that they would from their home country. They should have sought asylum in their sort of first safe country of entry. So there's like a bunch of actually pretty complicated questions on how international asylum law works and where it bites and binds, part A. And part B, there's also a real conflation of border entry, especially in the president's discussions on whether, frankly, migrants, and as Aaron said, economic migrants and sort of asylum seekers and those seeking sort of fleeing from safety conditions and where those overlap, how do we think about assigning a particular migration status to a given individual or family? And I think that's sort of the heart of the question here, where people are fleeing from essentially very poor with very little economic opportunity conditions that are also not terribly safe. And sort of how do we draw these lines and what do we need to do for asylum seeking? What do we want to do as a country on these policies? And I think that's kind of what's being played out both in the political rhetoric and on an individual case by case basis at the border.
It does seem to be the case. I mean, there's an extraordinary amount of violence in a number of these countries, but it's often maybe described as social violence or criminal violence. It's not political violence per se, and so it's not political persecution per se, as is described in the asylum laws. And, you know, I think it's just one of these things where, you know, there's real dislocation, there is real fear for personal safety, which would in some ways meet the standard historically of asylum law, but it's not based on these categories of, you know, national origin or religion or political views. It's that you live in the wrong neighborhood and, you know, there's extraordinary, you know, gang or criminal violence or other things that the government has been unwilling or unable to manage on your behalf. And, you know, that's been a gap for quite some time with regard to refugee status and asylum law. You know, I don't know. Did you debate the immigration topic in high school, Radha?
I sure did.
Yeah, me too. And this was like a related type case then, although then it wasn't about Central America. It was about, you know, Cuba and Haiti and a few other places. But, you know, I think to my mind, there's sort of also no doubt that this is being stoked for domestic political reasons and midterm elections.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're having that in that exchange there. That was a kind of technocratic, interesting legal debate, legal and policy debate about how do you approach this issue, which is in no way related to how the president of the United States is approaching this, which is much more of a, I'm shutting down the border and putting the military there to prevent you from coming in, regardless of international law.
And cutting aid to the countries.
Right.
Who are like, I don't really seem to have a lot of control over the situation themselves. Let's be totally honest.
So I guess it'll be interesting to see if anybody still cares about this in December, and we'll look forward to revisiting it then. Meanwhile, there was an extraordinary attack in Kandahar, Afghanistan this week. And listeners to the show and others have probably been following Afghanistan for, I don't know, maybe literally your entire adult lives at this point. But it is a little bit hard sometimes, I think, to be shocked by events there. And I was dead shocked by this attack. I don't know. Lauren Arata, do you have the roster of exactly who was ended up being killed?
The ostensible target of the attack was the police chief, Abdul Razik, whose name is probably familiar to a lot of people who've been following Afghanistan for a long time. He was killed, as was Abdul Momin. I apologize for butchering the name. He was the head of intelligence of the province. Governor Zalmay Wessa was also wounded. Also wounded in the attack was Brigadier General, U.S. Brigadier General Jeff Smiley, who was the head of the Trained Advice Assist Command there. And present was the commander of international forces in Afghanistan, Scotty Miller.
Which, as I think I said on Twitter, you know, I can talk analytically about Afghanistan kind of all day long. But if Scotty Miller had been hurt or killed, I think I would have just kind of lost my mind. Rod and I both worked for him when we were in Afghanistan, which seems like now three lifetimes ago. but that it's an extraordinary attack, and again, came from one of the governor's bodyguards. This is not the first time a governor of Kandahar's bodyguards have turned or been flipped, and the Taliban has claimed responsibility for the attack. So there are parliamentary elections this week.
Yeah, that took place on Saturday.
They did. And then I think they delayed voting in Kandahar by a week in response to the attack, obviously having lots of folks sort of waiting for extended period of times in pretty unsafe conditions in order to vote in those elections with, a good amount of violence and a lot of fear sort of surrounding it.
And this has the potential, I don't want to overstate the case too much, but this has the potential to have a significant effect on Kandahar. Razik was a bit of a one-man band. Not in the sense that he had no other allies, but he was in total control in many ways of the region and has been for years.
Because he controls both the criminal patronage networks and the other pieces of the formal security structure.
He was really good at cracking down.
Right. Any possible allegation you could make against the man in terms of extrajudicial killings, human rights abuses, torture, and
drug smuggling.
He has done them all and probably would happily admit to them, but at the same time has been a close U.S. ally in the last several years or so.
I was also surprised to see that there were a number of op-eds, including at some conservative publications, that were basically like, the show's over, folks. Like, we might as well cut losses and get out now. And so, again, somewhat similar to, you know, this particular incident with Khashoggi in Saudi Arabia, it'll be interesting to me to see if this becomes a fulcrum, because it captured imagination in just the right way for shifts overall in Afghanistan policy. I don't know who the big defenders are for the current policy in Afghanistan now that General McMaster is no longer the National Security Advisor. This is very much his plan. And I could see, you know, if the right person got in front of the president in the next few weeks, you might see some shifts. So I guess we'll kind of keep an eye on there. It could also just totally blow over and be back to business as usual within a week or 10 days. It's really hard to say.
That's pretty much the story of Afghanistan, isn't it? I mean,
it really, really is. All right, Radha, you have some really exciting news for us in It's a Gas with regard to the International Postal Union.
Yeah, Universal Postal Union. I'm very
Universal Postal
that's
Union.
Right, that's right.
It's intergalactic.
It is intergalactic. I mean, it does negotiate all the rates and it's pretty secretive. So in fairness, we may not know what they do and don't negotiate.
Okay, well, before you tell us how it works, remind us why we're talking about it.
Right. So we're quitting it, maybe. We've announced the Trump administration announced its intent to leave the agreement just this past week. The sort of issue is that they are concerned that it disproportionately benefits China and a couple other countries in shipping their packages. So for folks who don't...
Are you kidding?
No.
Like, that's the beef?
Do you know how many Amazon packages I get from China? A lot.
Right. So they coordinate the payments that you have to make. And in particular, what they do is negotiate the rates that places are paid for the last mile of delivery. And if you haven't listened to it, I actually amazingly had already listened to this daily, the Planet Money podcast on this like a couple weeks ago. It's like maybe from a month ago on the Postal Illuminati, which doesn't cover it as
totally
it relates to this.
That stuff to you. That's why we have you here, because we're not going to listen to that.
It was great. It's really entertaining. It's like this conspiracy theorist guy. They talk to the leading economist on postal economics to tell you about the underlying cost versus prices. The basic issue is...
I already fell asleep.
But the basic issue and the interesting part is, turns out China gets to pay really super duper low rates because when we signed the treaty in like the 1960s, they were a developing country. And so the beef that has existed and actually is like pretty legitimate is that they pay really, really low amounts for shipping, for delivering into the US and Europe in particular. And those rates are not commensurate. And so that it is actually cheaper in most cases for things to be shipped from China to places in the U.S. than from the U.S. to other places in the U.S., including like in your same state or even in your same neighborhood. And so that's kind of the underlying issue. Now, the solution probably shouldn't be to quit. And the reason is because then you need to negotiate bilateral payments for delivery for all of the goods that you want from every country individually, right? Which is like kind of a pain, and the whole reason why the postal union was set up. So that's part A. And part B is also like, we're not the only ones affected by this, in the sense that like China is still on this very low cost developing country list. Probably shouldn't be. That means that China can flood markets like the US, but also like Europe, right? Who should be natural allies in this to help us negotiate or renegotiate some of the rates. Now, this Universal Postal Union is not a super transparent process or decision-making body. It's an international group largely comprised of representatives from different postal services across the world, and they are based in Switzerland, and they sort of negotiate and set the rates.
Of course they are.
Right. Set the rates globally. But one could imagine a different approach to this, which would be to get together with a set of people who were being disadvantaged from this and try to work out a solution that then could be pushed through this bureaucratic body. So that's not what's happening here. But we do have a 12-month period from announcing our intention to leave to actually leaving, which could sort of leave some room, you know, for this to get renegotiated or for us to have a different solution. And even the administration in questions about this, there's a nice Washington Post article about it, admitted that there were, quote, some benefits to remaining in this agreement, like being able to ship stuff globally. So I think, you know, the big takeaway is really this is what seems like a pretty esoteric way to try to help U.S. produced goods ship at the same cost. It actually has a huge number of unintended consequences and unintended cost consequences, not the least of which is how much will it cost for U.S. companies to ship things not just to China, but to like everywhere and anywhere, and how much will it cost them to receive their, say, intermediate parts and stuff that they need to make their goods and services? So all of those questions remain unanswered. I'm sure that Erin has her shocked face on about that. And so we kind of don't have a good sense on the cost alternative or really what the counterfactual is to the current system. And I think that's why everyone has been sort of scrambling to try to figure out what an alternative shipping, international shipping system in which the U.S. sets its own rates might look like. So stay tuned for that. I'm sure you won't, but I'll probably tell you about it at some future episode. So stay tuned for that.
So what I'm hearing is that there's an international treaty where somebody is getting, you know, kind of like preferential treatment, or maybe is taking advantage of us a little. And instead of trying to renegotiate it, we're just going to take our ball and go home.
That's right.
I think I've heard of this happening before. John Bolton maybe has a bit of an issue with commitment.
John Bolton, we totally need the dating theory version, the rom-com theory of John Bolton.
This is, you know, I don't have any time at work right now, but the day I do, I am doing a deep dive on John Bolton relationships and commitment. So if you've got tips, send them my way.
So what we're talking about, if we shift over to White House mayhem, is the administration announced this week its intent to withdraw from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, which is everyone's favorite nuclear forces treaty from the 1980s. It's kind of lesser known. I mean, it's kind of like if you're a Radiohead fan and you're like, Amnesiac is my favorite album. It's nobody's favorite album. I mean, it's my favorite album, but like, it's not the like biggest hits. So it's not your Start Two. It's not your Salt Agreement. It's not your Reykjavik Accords.
It's only an executive agreement too, right?
Why did you ask me a question that I didn't have an answer to for
sure
this?
It is.
Well, I actually think the Senate ratified it, but the Senate does not have to do anything for us to leave.
Okay, there we go.
Which was clarified. Yeah. So, for the folks keeping score at home, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, also known as the INF Treaty, was signed in 1987, and it applies to all land-based ballistic and cruise missiles with ranges between 500 and 5,500 kilometers. All of those words are meaningful in that sentence. That's actually taken from a CRS report, which are now available from their own actual link, which is exciting to our tens and tens of fans who love to read CRS reports. They're very handy. Amy Wolf at CRS does incredible work on strategic and nuclear issues. So I'm quoting from her. There's a lot of reasons why people are kind of cranky about the INF Treaty. The two big ones, I guess, are one, people think that Russia's basically in violation of it. They've been developing some short-range missiles, which we think are conventionally loaded, which is probably in violation. And they may or may not have deployed them. That's a little iffy. But the Chinese, who are not party to the INF Treaty, because the INF Treaty is only between the United States and Russia, have been building intermediate-range missiles. I mean, just like Gedzooks. Like, they're all over the coast of China. They're an integral part of their kind of anti-access denial strategy. And so they have gobs of intermediate-range missiles. And we're a little irritated that we don't.
So with all that being said, my fundamental question is, other than just being pissed off and, like, definitively saying we are pissed off about this, or both of those events, does withdrawing actually help us in any way? Like, because we can't turn around tomorrow and start developing missiles that are within this range. We don't have any capability to do so quickly. We could over time. So we're not going to be able to catch up with Russia. We likewise are not going to be able to catch up with the Chinese. And even if we did, I'm not necessarily sure where we would base such missiles.
That's the best question.
In Asia. So, I mean, it's a nice, like, hey, I'm super pissed about this statement, but I guess I just don't really know, particularly since I think the existence of the treaty itself gives us the ability to better sanction Russia, either formally or via other means. Like, how does this, other than, how does this help us?
So I don't have a good answer for that, but I will say that in another, you know, on Earth too, where we had a different relationship with China, one could imagine this as part of a strategy to sort of rethink this sort of intermediate range missile nuclear treaty agreement as a like structure rather than one just between the US and Russia, one that took into account sort of the revised state of the world nuclear states and what we might want to do with that. Now, obviously, given our current relationship with China, see us just quitting an esoteric postal union about them. Like, that doesn't seem likely, but it does feel to me here like there is like contract space and opportunity space in theory, not in practice, to have a better and more thoughtful approach to these intermediate range missiles. So like, maybe scrapping this is the first step in that ish. It's just going to have a little pause between now and when the second step happens.
Yeah, that's not how you would do that if you really wanted to do that.
I know. I was trying to glass full this.
I mean, the other thing is that, so actually, like, South Korea and Japan are also not parties to this treaty. And so if they wanted to have intermediate range missiles because they thought they were, you know, vulnerable to Chinese attack and wanted to create more conventional deterrence, they would also be free to do so. Japan and South Korea being two places we would try to potentially base some sort of mobile GLICM or some sort of mobile intermediate range missiles, putting them in Guam makes them real far away, but I guess it's like kind of an option. But it just turns out like our land access in the Pacific is limited, which is why like PACOM is a naval command.
I mean, I don't know these things, but like, can we not base this stuff on ships like and submarines?
That's the whole point of the treaty.
It turns out that's completely allowed.
Right. Oh. Whole point of the treaty is this grounds.
We can put them on airplanes too.
Right.
Oh,
so
great.
I guess in theory, we could do what the Chinese are doing and basically just start building some islands out in the middle of the Pacific.
Oh, let's just do that.
Yeah, we do that.
We should build some islands.
Right, right. Go look up Slick'em. Go look up low yield Slick'em and just have yourself a time. You'll be delighted.
I probably won't do that. Let's trade. You tell me and I'll keep you up to date on the postal stuff.
The other question I have about this is, have the Europeans, what do the Europeans think about this?
Like, not
have
thrilled.
they I wouldn't imagine they're thrilled, but have they really said anything?
So the origins of the INF Treaty in the 80s were related to our deployment of Pershing missiles to Germany earlier in the 1980s. This gets into the very complicated things about exactly how the Germans felt during the Cold War, which, you know, you're going to need some good beer, maybe even some Jägermeister to get through that conversation. The Germans weren't super thrilled about having, these were nuclear missiles, actually, short range or intermediate range nuclear missiles. They weren't thrilled about that. They are unlikely to be thrilled about them returning. What I have read is that the Poles are the most likely candidates for positioning conventional intermediate range missiles. No one on the U.S. side right now is talking about developing nuclear intermediate range missiles, although maybe give them a minute. They've come up with some other interesting ideas if you're in part of the nuclear war fighting crowd these days. But Poland would seem to be a possible place. I have not seen exactly how cranky Angela Merkel is about this, but I don't think
she's got other problems
thrilled.
Right now.
She does have some other problems right now. So that's the INF Treaty, a real blast from the past, and will be very interesting to see if we, in fact, formally do withdraw. And one thing for other folks to keep an eye on is how that also would then affect potential extension or renegotiation of New START, which is the much larger strategic forces treaty between the U.S. and Russia, which is set to expire in, I think, 2020.
So I guess if you believed that there were five-dimensional chess players in the administration, that you would assume that this is all part of a bigger plan in terms of the New START renegotiation. I do not believe this.
I reject that wholesale.
Particularly given what
John
we know,
Bolton hates John both Bolton. Agreements. He wants to torpedo them both with or without nuclear right. attachment. You know, like,
as does his senior director for nonproliferation and arms control.
Correct.
They both hate them. They don't want to deal with this.
And it's not the core area of interest or expertise of the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of State, for that matter. So the White House is leading from the front on this matter. One other place where the White House is leading, we'll round out White House mayhem with a off-the-cuff comment from the president at a cabinet meeting this week, where he...
That's always fun.
That's a great way to make policy. Where he said that he was going to direct all of the cabinet agencies to reduce their budget by 5%. So that's neat.
It's great. I mean, to be fair, he said maybe for the Department of Defense, he wouldn't do 5%. He would just ask them to go from $716 billion to $700 billion, a nice round number. So that's only about a 2% cut. But the entire damn point of all of his last 2 years of a defense policy has been like, I am increasing the size of the military. I'm giving them so much more money. They're going to build more ships and the army will be bigger and so on and so forth. Start cutting. You can't do basic. I mean, even where we are right now, you can barely do any of those things. Start cutting. You really can't do any of those things.
You can if you make the best deals.
I can't wait to see what the budget is the department submits and whether they just shift a whole bunch of stuff back into OCO, which would be the obvious solution to.
Well, that's where I would put the new intermediate range missiles right there. Just put it in OCO.
Exactly.
Put it in OCO.
Do we have any pop culture?
I have just finished reading Death Comes to Pemberley, which I've discovered, first of all, that Radha has not read.
It's like, I feel like I don't know what happened here. I've really dropped the ball. I'm so sorry.
It's a sort of faux sequel to Pride and Prejudice by P.D. James. So combining her great loves of Jane Austen as well as a murder mystery. And it's pretty a murder mystery. Like it's a fairly dark story, but at the same time, you get to catch up with all of your old favorite characters in a way that is truly credible and not just sort of fan fiction-esque. And even better, on Netflix, there is a miniseries that has Matthew Good as Wickham and Matthew Rhys as Darcy.
You had me at Matthew Good. There's also going to be a live adaptation of Les Mis that's not a musical.
Why bother?
Well, because there's still some... It turns out there's a classic novel as the source material.
It is. It's actually really excellent. I recommend it.
I mean, it's good, but if anyone wants to do some Les Mis karaoke with me, I'm all about it.
I could also do that.
I will totally do that with you. We should do that. I think I mentioned last week that I was going to see A Star is Born, and I've now just been listening to the soundtrack on repeat for two straight weeks. So everybody else should also be doing that, and you can come do A Star is Born karaoke along with the Les Mis karaoke, as long as I have something to say about it.
I think we figured out the theme for the next bombshell party.
Radha, do you have any pop culture?
I don't. I'm sorry.
Sad.
I know. But now I have future pop culture in watching this miniseries on Netflix.
It's going to be great.
I'll send you a copy of Cryptonomicon.
But not at local discount rates.
No. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. We'll see you in a couple weeks.